As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Okay, David Neuhauser of Livermore Partners, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. The economic recovery, the V-shape, is effectively priced into markets as we record this on Thursday, June 25th. The S&P 500 is up well over 30% off its lows. It seems that there is very little that can upend this buying mentality on Wall Street from investors, whether those investors are people of the Robin Hood crowd or more of the larger institutions, which is another question for another day. But your views here are a lot more bearish, and you are anticipating an L-shaped recovery, which is a bit of a misnomer, because if it is an L shape, then it doesn't really recover, does it? So I'd be really interested in having you lay out your views here for us.
Yeah, for sure, Nate. And thanks for having me. I mean, the way you look at it is you have to still look at, you know, markets is just like economies run in cycles. And if you look at the past decade, as we've known, it's been predicated on low interest rates, which has caused by central banks, that has caused obviously economic development and along with tax cuts. And that's where we've seen the massive amounts of stimulus, which has fueled growth for a number of years. All that's great. We obviously seen now with COVID-19 that that's been upended. And to fight that, of course, we've seen massive economic stimulus from both government and the Federal Reserve Bank. And that, of course, is helping propel markets. But I do think there's two things you have to look at. One is the economy, as they say, and there's one that there's the markets. Mm. And from an economic standpoint, even with a vaccine, which, you know, at a bull case, I would say you're talking about 12 months or 18 months from now, you're still going to look at sustainable higher levels of unemployment. You're still going to see a lot lower economic activity. You're still going to see, you know, just less overall activity in the economy in terms of retail, in terms of travel and leisure, in terms of purchases. And when you include that all in to where we've been, to where we are today and where we're going, you have to look at it and say, you know, big picture, you know, we most likely have seen the best days behind us in the past, you know, 5 or 10 years. And going forward, it's going to be a rough road.
And do you anticipate there to be a drop in the markets or just more of just like sideways activity as we've maybe seen here more lately?
Yeah, I think you're going to see some sideways activity in the near term, because one is the market sort of got its footing under its feet short term. We had this again. We went from this big bull cycle to a very quick bear cycle. And, you know, we had a massive reset in the market, which saw, you know, the S&P tank 1,000 points, which obviously took us down about 220 on the SPY index. And now we're back up to just over 300. And normally people look at that and that equates to it to the sort of V recovery in the markets led by a number of Fed stimulus. But I also think, A, there's been bad behavior going on in the market as far as the talk of some retail traders popping up who, you know, have capital, and they've seen this before where you buy every dip and you get rewarded. And I think short term they have been rewarded if you've taken the plunge. I think you just have to look at it over the next, you know, year or two or three. And I think it's going to be much more challenging. So I expect the markets to be relatively range bound in the short run. I think any dynamic, just like you saw last week with higher second wave of COVID taking place, is going to cause more economic pain. And thus, you know, you'll see pullbacks to the markets like we're seeing.
What if the Fed does come in and say, start something really unconventional, like buying stocks? They've done just about everything else. That would obviously be a big boost for the market. And some people might say that that's the market's already expecting this, like this is already priced in. But what do you think about that? Or are there fiscal things that might happen, right? Like an infrastructure bill? I mean, let's not get into the politics of whether that's feasible, but things like that, you know, more you know, relief measures for unemployed people or for others. What do you think about all that? Wouldn't that boost the market?
You know, I think there's things they can still do. You know, obviously, I think there's still some gunpowder left from both the Fed and of course, government. But I think the you know, Fed is clearly stating that we need to see more from government than the Fed at this point. The Fed's done just about everything possible they can do to, you know, really juice the markets, which to me is there's a bit of more hazard in that statement, because, you know, one thing buying, you know, corporate bonds, there's another thing buying things like junk bonds. Mm. And then there's a huge step if you would actually start to buy equities of companies. So, you know, to me, a market should function in a capitalistic manner. And when a company makes bad bets and puts on big leverage and things go wrong, they should suffer the consequences, as should their shareholders. And I think that's what capitalism is all about, is that, you know, you have this reset during times in which people make bad decisions. And when times make, you know, good decisions, they're going to get rewarded and they're going to grow shareholder value over time. So I think the Fed is really upending that model by throwing this massive amounts of stimulus in areas of the market. And if they would do so in equities, I think that in some degree that's a bit priced in. You have the Fed put where people believe the market will not fall substantially anymore because of the Fed, and ultimately they'll be the buyer of last resort. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's a huge leap. And I think today there's a lot of foolish behavior going on in the market, and ultimately they're going to pay.
How much of that do you think is already priced in? This expectation that, yeah, the Fed put, but do you think that there is an element of that in the market today?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that, look, if you look at a trailing or even a go forward basis, even with a rebound in, say, economic activity over the next 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you still get to, you know, an inflated S&P price to earnings ratio. And I just don't see that being sustainable. So you have to keep believing that things are going to recover the same way they were before. And I don't see that happening. I mean, even though the Fed is there in terms of saying they're not raising rates for the next few years, that's only going to go so far. So you've had mortgage refinancings, which has been massive. You've had other, you know, credit issues come up as far as stimulus, as far as unemployment benefits have been extended. You've seen the PPP bill, which has been very successful. All these things are great to see from our government to help keep economic activity going. The question is, can we start on our own to get the train kind of on the right track and start to see that build into its own growth rate? And that, I think, is going to be the question. And I think ultimately that's not going to occur the way it is. So we're going to see this period, in my view, of very low, you know, to no growth for a number of years. And that's where I see that L shape occurring. And as far as the markets, I think eventually they're going to take that cue, or once they see that they're not going to see the type of growth and they're not going to see the kind of, you know, further interest from the Fed, I'll say, to prop up their equity prices and the economy, I think then all of a sudden you're going to start to see that a massive reset of stocks, especially the stocks that have taken on this life of their own, which is mainly tech that is money losing tech. These are names that all of a sudden are you know, massive size companies like Tesla, things mm-hmm. like Carvana, which makes no money. And, you know, the disruptors that we've heard about for the number of years, those are the stocks that have done really well. And I think mm-hmm. ultimately, if you own those companies anywhere around today's valuation, it's going to be a real challenge.
Yeah, this all raises the question, and you touched on it. Where does an investor go with his or her money in this at this stage?
Yeah, so what's interesting is, you know, when you're talking about being a contrarian, you know, typically you're trying to buy things low that are out of favor, thinking that eventually they're going to reset back at least to a mean, if not actually potentially higher.
Right.
And what's funny, I think, today is that contrarian today means the complete opposite of what it normally does.
That's right.
So my contrarian bet is, I think some of the things that have worked in the past 10 years, which again goes back to the same thing, the bubble stocks I view of high growth, high value, mainly money losing, you know, innovative technology shares are going to be the ones that are going to be suffer. I think that's the contrarian bet, to bet against those companies. And I think the ones you want to own as the contrarian are the ones that, yes, are a bit boring. They're things that are, like we've talked about, hard assets in sectors like, you know, materials and gold and mining and oil and gas, things that people feel that have limited upside, typically given the massive oversupply of a number of years. So they're boring situations. But again, at Livermore, we're looking for those specific companies, special situations, event driven, where we can, you know, invest in those companies, be patient capital, and watch for the value to be unlocked, whether it be in a passive manner or whether it be a proactive manner. But I think those are the areas of value today.
Right.
And that's been something that hasn't been rewarded for a long time now. And I think if you look out over the next at least few years from today, right now, you'll see those sectors will either A, hold up extremely well, or two, actually inflate well as you see either inflation or stagflation take hold in the next few years.
Cool. I want to get some specifics from you on that. See if we can get some more information on the types of situations you're involved with and some stock picks as well. But let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We're on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Okay, welcome back. We are back for the second half with David Neuhauser of Livermore Partners. Very excited to have you on the podcast. This is the section of the show where our guest tells us a little bit more about themselves, about their background, how they got into investing, and their career to date. So let's hear it from you. How did things start, and how did they transpire to get you where you are now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I got started in finance just back in a university, which I went to school here in Chicago at Northeastern Illinois, and you know, graduated in economics and just took a real passion into finance. And you know, from there, ultimately got a job at the Chicago Stock Exchange, which is downtown, and worked in market regulation, which is kind of like catching the bad guys. Some of the specialists on the floor at the time would front run traders and things like that. So I got a taste, firsthand on the floor. And there I met a number of the traders that were doing different type of trading techniques, including arbitrage trading, which I ran to a group then, which was a young group that was extremely successful. And, you know, they made a lot of money with their hedge fund strategies, which was risk arb. And that really interested me. And from there, kind of my usual nature of being inquisitive is I reached out to someone at the firm and ultimately went to go work for that group for a number of years, where I kind of learned my forte into, you know, activist investing, contrarian investing, as far as looking at, you know, value and also short selling at times, which we employ when we look at unique situations to profit from downside or as a hedging tool. So we don't necessarily have to be short. It's just one of the things that I've learned over the years. So, you know, my 20 plus year career, that's some of the things, Nate, I've been focused on. And from there, you know, I broke off on my own and became a member of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and learned more of the commodities type trading there on my own for about 5 years. I was a member. And then in 2009, I started Livermore, which was mainly like a consulting company because I had some of my own capital, but I didn't really have a lot of contacts. So at that time, I kind of reached out to different groups like private equity and others, which I didn't know. And I was able to find deals and look at special situations in which I would personally invest capital in. And by 2014, 15, 16, I was running into a number of situations similar to my time, again, at our previous fund, the group of guys I worked with there, is that I needed capital to execute and started an LP. And we have the LP and we've moved forward now on making a number of investments. And the hedge fund's been operational for, 4 or 5 years. We're small hedge fund, Livermore Partners, but we're very dynamic. And, we've accomplished a lot, I would think, in our short track record. We've ran about 8 activist processes in the past number of years. You know, we sit on 3 different boards, including Jadestone Energy, which years ago was an activist process itself. And today it's a, $300 million market cap company in London that's free cash flow with no debt and nice cash balance. And that and other situations we've involved in, which we've discussed in the past, things like Detour Gold, which was our last activist process with John Paulson and company, which was very successful, ultimately sold to Kirkland Lake just last year. We made a over 100% return on our investment in about 18 months. And so I'm using my time as far as my history, in investing, what I learned is, investing can humble you really bad in terms of, you do things really well at times and you have great success. And then you think it's always going to be that way. And some of the things I even talked to my son about today is I tell him, like, things aren't always going to be good and you have to prepare. So I always try to look at the downside and look at things that can happen to alter sort of the landscape of a company or the market. And we look at that being first and foremost. And then, of course, I want the optionality, so to speak, as far as the upside. So we've been able to capture that again with a number of very specific companies over the last 4 or 5 years now. And, the goal is to keep growing Livermore, but yet be a nimble event-driven hedge fund that could do a number of different things. Things that we can change the sort of strategy and dynamics of a company, also make bold bets at times, which are more concentrated, and, make strong absolute returns, which has been extremely difficult in a market that's, like I said, being juiced up by the Fed Reserve and low interest rates. But we've been able to manage through it. This year has been tougher than last year, which we did extremely well. Just best year ever for Livermore to date. And we've had some, really big up years, which have been phenomenal. And yet we've had a few down years. And the goal is to try to look for, situations again where we can have that huge up a year and have that big tail move in equities and in situations. And that's kind of what I strive for on a go forward basis.
Interesting. What percentage of the fund is, or what percentage of your time is dedicated to activist campaigns versus, which would be other event-driven trading? For special situations type of stuff. I guess activism is special situations, but yeah.
Yeah, it is. But I think for activism, like, we're not an activist fund where our mandate is activist situations just to affect change.
Right.
So activism has come up in the past because I'm a first and foremost a value investor. So when I find a value situation that I'm actually very intrigued by and interested in, I try to figure out, well, why is there a disconnect to the market? It's easy to say there's a lot of value. Sometimes there's a very good reason why there's, the stock is not priced the way it should be. And you really have to figure that out. So what we've run across, I would say again, in my history is that some situations there's companies, again, I'm not talking stocks, I'm saying companies that we invest in have a lot of value. And the issue is the stock price is not reflected of that value. So why is my big question. Again, going back to what I'm talking about being inquisitive, is you have to be inquisitive. You have to look at situations and try to find out, you know, what's causing that. And what we've come across is situations that there's been that disconnect in value, and it's because there's a flawed strategy, it's a capital structure that's weak, or it's just you know, obviously a management governance issue that, you know, these guys aren't doing the right things to enhance the business. So as I've come across that, we've had, of course, discussions with these teams, a number of different teams over the past my career and decades, except sometimes you come across situations in which there's tremendous value. You see a path of value, and yet the management and even board does not agree with you. So that's when, you know, you have to become proactive, and that looks at changing boards and writing letters to their board and trying to manifest change. And, you know, like I said, the processes that we've involved in have occurred because we've had that pushback from teams. Detour Gold was one that the management team believed they were doing the right thing. Obviously they were doing the wrong thing. Before that, we owned a company called Entertainment One, which is listed in London, which recently has been acquired by Hasbro. You know, we ran activist campaign back in 2015, and the shares were like 150 pence, and they got, you know, sold to Hasbro for 500 pence. And our view was, you know, that management needs to alter their strategy. And a lot of times you just get these groups that are entrenched, and they have their own way of thinking. So being more proactive, I think, is a valuable tool for investors today. And it's worked. Okay.
What kind of situations then now, and you mentioned earlier the energy producers, and where are you seeing value, and what types of situations are you involved with now?
Yeah, so you know, energy, we talked about obviously before, we mentioned some things we're involved in, and what I've been saying, I'll say at least for a number of years, has been, you know, I've disliked shale. I think this shale is just, you know, as they talk about, a treadmill. And my viewpoint has always been, I want to own companies that can generate free cash flow and actually can build their production base, but also can build the reserves. But mainly I want to see that cash flow, and I want to see free cash flow. I want to know, if I'm giving you my money and investing in the company, what am I getting in return from it? And in the past, mainly with shale, it's been more production, more debt. And for a short period of time, it equated to a higher share price. So you had a bunch of institutional capital chase shale, which I thought would ultimately implode. And today, with lower prices and no financing around, you're starting to see a number of shale situations implode. And we've been making money on situations, like I mentioned, Jadestone Energy, which, again, free cash flow company with zero debt, cash on their balance sheet, which is looking to do exactly what you should be doing in today's environment, which is, we're trying to buy depressed operating assets, you know, acquire them, rationalize them, make them stronger, better, generate free cash, and do it again and again and again. And that's what you do in down cycles, is you want to be in that position with your balance sheet and with your management team where you could take advantage of distress. You know, my view is, I see myself as a distressed investor always. And I want to find situations that are mispriced, or at least that the company and the management team is so focused on delivering value for their shareholders. And those are the situations you want to be invested in, something like Jadestone. Other things we've mentioned, at least in the past, have been things like Vista Oil and Gas, which is a player in Argentina, which we think is slowly opening up, and we think there's potential growth there. And that's, you know, totally different business model, but the focus is on growth. And again, they have a strong management team. And then there's a few other companies I won't mention today because we're involved in terms of doing research on, which, you know, so one's, you know, it's about a $400 million market cap. The other's about $1 billion. And those are unique too, because the goal for those companies, very short term, is to generate a lot of free cash flow. They're mainly more of a fixed gas type investment. Even something Jadestone's focused on a bit, and it fixed gas as a diversifier away from oil. And the goal there, again, of these other companies that we're involved in, is to look to grow free cash flow and see a capital return and or value to the equity holders. So those are the situations I would focus on, at least in the energy space. And again, our theme at Livermore remains, we feel that, you know, all the Fed stimulus is going to create either inflation to potential stagflation, more of that L shape, which would be stagflation, would be no growth, but yet prices are appreciating. And I think the things that are most scarce in the world today, which are things like, you know, gold, which are things like, you know, different commodities like copper and even oil to some degree, even though it looks like it's oversupplied today because of the demand issue. I think as that comes back and with less CapEx, the potential for crude is actually very strong.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned demand picture. I mean, is there a concern there that that could kind of go sideways or drop even? Because if you are looking at an L-shaped recovery or economy or what have you, where there is little economic expansion, especially from countries like China, which, as we know, is like the biggest consumer of things like copper and oil and such. Is that a concern at all?
No, it is. And I think it's always a concern. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I think, again, you have to look at where you are in the cycle of things, mm-hmm. where you're in the cycle on a macro basis as far as the global economy, and then where we are in terms of, you know, some of the supply demand dynamics at play. And one of the things that has occurred over the past even decade is we had this boom in commodities, you know, 10 plus years ago now. It's been a long time. We had oil over $100 a barrel, and we had, you know, copper at, you know, $8,000, $9,000 a ton, things like that. And gold at $1,800 an ounce. And, you know, we went through a decade in which all those prices were getting crushed and massive supply. But, you know, today's a really interesting dynamic, which the L shape creates, like I said, low to no growth for the potential for a number of years to get through COVID, to get through all the oversupply and just carnage that's happening in, you know, in the world today in terms of retail and commercial property, things like that. And of course, unemployment, which is going to remain very high, it looks like, for at least a number of years. But the thing is, if you look at a number of these commodities, you know, you need the demand, but the one thing, you know, the opposite of the other aspect of the cycle is supply. And you're seeing so much less capital investment in these businesses, in gold mining business, in copper, like I said, and even oil now, which we've seen more and more pullback at CapEx. And eventually, with an increase in demand over time, which again could still be 2, 3, 4 years away, you will start to see a very tight supply-demand picture, and therefore prices will be much higher. So I'm not necessarily banking on demand to come back in a massive fashion.
Yeah.
I just think that the supply-demand dynamics, the equilibrium, is going to get really close very quickly, and I think ultimately the demand is going to outstrip what's out there in supply, and that's mainly due to lack of investment.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's a bit of a contrarian theory there.
Big picture is kind of how to look at things. You know, we look at macro, micro situations on specific companies, like I'm saying, in their space. And I think big picture still, you know, I would say that, you know, we think there'll still be this massive reset in terms of markets today. Again, not being a very big bear, I'm just saying is that ultimately fundamentals will take hold. And if that occurs, we'll see, you know, we should see further grinding to the downside on a number of, I'd say, high price, high value sectors of the market. And I think those that remain, you know, undervalued, or I would say at least fairly valued, could be interesting situations to invest in. And that's kind of how we're looking at things at Livermore. But again, we're focused on those special situations that we can get involved in, either from an activist standpoint, or just because it's a value situation where we think there's great value and an investment opportunity over the years to come.
What can you tell us about your process as far as finding these opportunities? Like, how does it start with a simple screen, or how do you go about that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I would say it's a number of things. One is, you know, I research a lot of different aspects, mainly in things I understand. I think, you know, both Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger always talk about stick to your knitting, kind of stick to the things you understand. So Livermore, we focus mainly on, you know, industrials, energy, and financials. So my history, even on the activist side, has been on the financials, has been on energy, has been on materials and mining. So I'm sticking to that knitting, though, you know, we have gone a little bit outside that. So, you know, the entertainment one, activist position we had a few years ago was more media. We ran activist process to help change at Burberry, which is a luxury goods company. And so to me, it's like, I'm trying to find situations that are just really unique and maybe misunderstood at the time. So our research process, I would say, is not vanilla. It's really, I'm looking at, I'm just scouring kind of the universe and looking for special situations. So one is I'm looking at that universe in terms of what is our knitting of, the type of business we invest in, which is mainly small cap since we're a small fund. But then I'm also looking at sort of special situations that are one-off, and they could be larger companies too. And, if we have to, we partner with groups as well. And, so it kind of ranges, but typically it's screening and then really digging in to the metrics, to having conversations with the management team, to having conversations with even some of the institutional investors of that company. Some of the things I'm actually doing right as we speak, and that'll decide then ultimately are those things that are fit for investment. And then of course you want to look at the overall market dynamic of where you want to invest in timing. So it's easy to say, good idea. There's another thing to say, well, where should we be invested at what valuation, right? So that you're buying at the right prices. And that all is a bit more art than science, I would say. But the process in general is pretty standard as far as, finding unique situations, engaging, going through the potential positives and negatives of the situation. And then also, how that value is going to ultimately be unlocked. And then lastly, something people don't talk about is exit. How are you going to exit? When are you going to exit? And that's one of the biggest things that I think people have always had trouble with. I've had trouble with at times too, staying with things too long that are not working. And then of course, situations are doing really well, holding on for the long time. But, I think you just have to look at making, the best value and best decisions you can at the time with the information you have and move from there.
Yeah. At what point what if there is like a stop loss? Like, do you put stop losses on these things? Like, how much of a, are you willing to stomach here on an idea before? Because the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent type of thing, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So what I try to look at is I try not to let market forces dictate decisions. I try to look for whether or not the fundamentals of the company support the price. Meaning you can get a bad piece of news from a company, right? And the stock price could drop 20, 30%. And that might be a phenomenal opportunity to actually buy more shares if you own it, or just to get involved at that point. And I've done that in the past. Same thing with the upside. You might get great news out of a company and you own the stock and it's gone up well and you're thinking everything's wonderful. That might be the perfect time to start to unwind the position. So, you really have to focus on the fundamentals and realize, look from a both technical reason, look from the fundamental reason, and look from a cyclical reason of where you are. So a lot of things we invest in typically have been cyclical in nature, like, energy and gold and copper and things like that. And when you're investing in those companies, just like in financials, they tend to run cycles. There's, financials, there's credit where it expands and the economy expands and their balance sheet does well and they make a lot of cash and they buy shares back. And then there's bad times for financials, like right now, where all of a sudden their balance sheets are being tested in a very harsh fashion. So what I'm trying to say is, we'll look for situations that typically, like I said, are distressed situations or a time in which no one wants to be in those situations when we want to buy them. Mm-hmm. And when everyone wants to own them, those are the times we usually kind of get out of those situations.
Yeah.
So we want to buy at what we think is a discount to fair value, and we want to sell at or well above fair value. But it's, again, more art than science.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned financials, but that is not something that, from the sound of it, that you're very involved in now. Are you're not excited about that sector?
I'm not today. I think the positive, again, if you're an investor, is the balance sheets of those banks have been a lot stronger today than in history, right? And since the last financial crisis we've had, or even the one before that. I mean, there's been a number of them in at least my career. And so that's the positive. But still, the whole idea is, again, you'd want to invest in those companies when you think you've hit sort of the trough and you're actually going to see a path of sort of escape velocity where things are going to get better. Loan loss provisions are actually on the downtrend and economic growth is on the uptrend. And there's things that are going to create, you know, better value and better earnings for those companies and increased book value. And, you know, today I don't see that occurring. I think that we're still in a bloodletting mode. And like I said, unlike past cycles, even 08, 09, I do think this cycle's, you know, it's going to last. I mean, the good news is I think that historically, the economy has withstood a number of things thrown at it. So I'm trying to be optimistic and think about the next, you know, several years out. But when I look at the valuations of companies today and I look at what I think could happen, it just, for many companies, like I'm saying in the market today, it just doesn't make sense. I wouldn't invest in those. And that's why we're looking at, you know, alternative situations to invest in, and things like gold and things like other aspects.
Fair enough. All right. In closing, maybe you just tell our listeners how they can find more about you. I know you're pretty active on Twitter. Livermore Ops, is that what it is? Your Twitter
handle? Yeah, our Twitter handle is Livermore Ops, and we have a website, livermorepartners.com, and there's information for accredited investors on there as well that are interested in our fund and our investment style, and you know, that's how you can get a hold of me. I'm pretty open for the most part to talk to people who are interested in doing things, and you know, share a lot of passion for investing and have a longer time frame as far as letting things unfold. So you know, that's how we've always been focused. That's how I've always been focused in terms of my strategy, which, you know, Livermore is mainly me and a small support group. But we have a really strong Rolodex of, I would say, more high influential people that I talk to that are obviously in business. We have, you know, people that are LPs of our fund that are within, you know, private equity and other hedge funds and other areas of business. So, you know, I'm able to bounce a lot of ideas off of some people that are really focused and really in the tranches in terms of company specific. And I think that helps a lot as far as the sort of competitive advantage that we have at Livermore over some even bigger funds. And, you know, the goal is to keep pushing hard and keep working hard and, again, be humble and try to do well for investors over time.
Cool. And I'll put those links into the show notes as long along with the video of the and the presentation that you gave at our investing summit, our virtual investing summit a couple of weeks ago. Where you went into a little more detail on some of these names. Yeah, and that's been out there for a while and it has been very interesting. But I'll put the link in there again. Awesome. David Neuhauser, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time. Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.